Oh, there
no, I'm
nobody in the postseason.
All right, let's start with introductions.
Let's do it.
We'll start to my right.
Hi there, Alyssa Gertler, Metro.
Catherine Harrington, Metro Council.
Amanda Foots, Portland City Council.
Karen McLaren, Oregon Department of Land Conservation and Development, the longest name.
Over to me. Taylor.
Metro.
Pete Truax, Mayor, City of Forest Grove, representing other cities in Washington County other than Hillsborough and Beaverton. Thank God. Hillsborough and Beaverton.
Before I step into a landmine here, Gordon Hubbies, Tolden Valley Fire and Rescue, representing special districts in Washington County.
Carlotta Collette, Metro Council, District 2.
Ty Stover, City of Vancouver.
I always have food in my mouth when it comes to me. Betty Dominguez, Clackamas County Citizen Rep.
Larry Morgan, Toronto City Council.
Steve Calloway, representing the City of Hillsborough and Giants Nation.
Jackie Mann, City of Lake Oswego, City Council.
And Mark Gamba, I'm the Mayor of Milwaukee, and I represent other cities in Clackamas County. Let's start over there.
Ted Reed, Metro Planning and Development Staff. Tom Armstrong, City of Portland.
Tom Cooper, City of Hillsborough.
City of Hillsborough.
Lindsay Earson, Metro Council President Candidate, and former staffer to MPAC, former staffer to TPAC, former JPAC member, but never an MPAC member.
How did
that happen?
Someday you'll get.
Honest Latinsky, City of Beaverton.
Brad Wilson,
Hey, Fire Commissioner, working in his office.
Jamie Sassy, Metropolitan Ranger. Seth Capel, Washington County.
Adam Barber, Multnomah County Planning.
Eric Hessa, Truman.
Kathleen Kelly, Gresham. Carly Rice, Gresham.
All right, great. I do have some chair communications tonight. So, leading with racial equity approach workshop date. Save the date for the leading with racial equity approach for structural transformation workshop will be offered to MPAC and other Metro Advisory Committee members on Wednesday, November 1st from 6 to 8 p.m. here. Should I start off?
There, that's better.
The workshop is a training opportunity to learn more about why Metro is a growing growing number of jurisdictions around the country are using racial equity as a way to prioritize their work in order to serve all people more effectively. The workshop will explore how leading with a racial equity approach is an essential component to a strategy for structural transformation to create equity for all communities. The workshop is presented by Scott Wynn, a consultant and faculty member at the University of Washington School of Social Work. Until recently, he worked as a policy lead at the City of Seattle Race and Social Justice Initiative. Please put it on your calendar for November 1st, 6 to 8 p.m. here at Council Chamber. You will receive additional information soon via email.
Yeah, thanks.
Is there any citizen communication tonight? Seeing none, council update.
I'm doing the update tonight. So the first one is I wanted to invite you all to a special meeting. Our regular Metro Council meeting, October 19th, will be held in the evening instead of the afternoon, and it'll be in Forest Grove at Forest Grove Community Auditorium. And one of the reasons we're meeting out there, in addition to just exploring that cool town, is that we will be adopting the master plan for Chehalem Ridge Nature Park. So I think you all remember that's one of our bigger parks, 1,230 acres, about 15 minutes south. Thanks, sir. 15 minutes from Forest Grove and Cornelius. This will get me on the Grove link, right? Or do I get another dollar for mentioning Groveling?
No more where that came from.
Chehalem Ridge is home to restored Doug firs, oak, and madrone habitat, as well as beavers, bobcats, and other wildlife. So hope any or all of you can join us out there in Forest Grove, October 19th. The other thing, I think you all got a card about the Build Small, Live Large summit that's coming up in November 3rd through the 5th at Portland State University. This is a really cool summit. I'm just going to editorialize here because I just love this group. This is where there are some tours. You get to see some ADUs and some small dwellings, as well as really start learning about some of the problems and solutions to building ADUs and small dwellings in general. The keynoters this time will be Harriet Tregoning, who was the planning director for Washington, D.C., and Jake Wegman, who's a professor at the University of Texas in Austin, housing affordability expert. So there'll be a number of practical discussions about regulatory design and financing strategies for ADUs and small dwellings. So Saturday and Sunday, there'll be also option of tours and workshops. All of our jurisdictional staff and elected officials can get a special rate. So we included, there's a discount code, and we sent that out in the email announcement that went out to you from Councilor Sam Chase. If you didn't get it or you don't know how to find it in your emails, let us know and we can send it out again. But it's a discount code that'll let you get into the summit cheaper. And then I just wanted to give you a brief update on Willamette Falls Legacy Project. You may have seen we've gotten a little bit of media recently. We meaning the partners, Oregon City, Clackamas County, Metro, and the State of Oregon, have sent a letter to the property owner, Falls Legacy LLC. George Heidgerken is the principal partner there, asking that they sign permits that they're required to do as part of the easement agreement that they signed and granted to Metro. They have not signed those permit agreements. It's slowed us way down. We are at least a month behind already, and as I think all of you have done big construction projects, and you know time is money, and slowing down a huge project like that is going to really cost us. And we are in jeopardy of losing the $5 million, the initial bond grant of $5 million for that project. So we have not heard anything formal back yet from George. He's still not signed the permit applications, so we thought we would try to make it a little bit bigger issue to get it on his agenda. I think we've gotten his attention. Hopefully we'll be able to come back next meeting and tell you that all is fine and we are moving ahead. So that's all I have for tonight.
All right, and I would concur that the Build Small, Live Large conference is well worth attending. I unfortunately will not be able to this year. Council updates. All right, sorry, I did that already. Impact member.
How soon he forgets.
That's what I meant to say. Catherine.
I have one, if you wouldn't mind. Yeah. I was pleased to see that at their September 5th meeting, the Washington County Board of Commissioners adopted I screwed up on my little device here, and now I can't get it. They adopted a statement that rejects racism, bigotry, and violence. And I just wanted to congratulate Chair Dyke on this. We've had discussions around this table, particularly earlier this year, about sanctuary cities and sanctuary counties. And it's nice to see this statement. If you don't mind, if I just read it real quickly.
Sure.
Washington County unequivocally rejects racism, bigotry, and violence in all its forms. As a public organization serving one of Oregon's most racially and ethnically diverse communities, we have long stood for celebrating diversity, treating all people with dignity, honesty, and respect, and demonstrating an understanding and appreciation for cultural, religious, and other differences we may all have. For our many years, our strongly held position has been reflected in a variety of ways, including policies, plans, rules, procedures, proclamations, and community and employee events. We stand with those who would support these values, the right to peaceably assemble, and other principles adopted at the founding of our nation. So,
great. Very nice. Anybody else? All right. I would entertain a motion to approve the consent agenda, which has two items, MTAC nominations and the minutes of the September 13th, 2017. It has been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda. All those in favor?
Question. It said that the MTAC nominations are attached, but they're not attached to mine. So I'm wondering if...
Is it just an AOP one? I can speak to it.
Sure.
Okay, we have had a vacancy on MTAC for the representative for the industrial and commercial seat, which is appointed usually by the board of directors of NAOP. They have submitted the name of Dr. Gerald Milner, professor at PSU, as their representative. So that is the nomination.
Yeah. They were out.
Yeah, yes. All right. So, all those in favor? Are you okay?
Yeah.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? None heard. It passes unanimously.
I do have a question on that, though. What's the motion to vote on him?
That is a good question. I don't have the roster in front of me, but as part of our strategic plan to advance racial equity and diversity, we have a policy around representation on all of our committees, and MTAC has some representatives appointed by Metro and others appointed by jurisdictions and representatives, so it's an evolving conversation about the membership of MTAC.
And obviously Dr. Milner is a renowned expert. In the future, I'd like to know who else was considered and what the process was for getting the nominee to say yes.
Actually, I'm happy to talk to you more. I actually had an extensive conversation with NAOP about their representative, but
right,
we can talk offline.
But this is one that's actually designated by a community, so we don't have the opportunity to say whether we've got it. Thank you.
Okay. Item 6.1. Expectations for cities proposing residential UGB expansions. This discussion item is the follow-through on some of the recommendations made last year by the Urban Growth Readiness Task Force, a group convened by Council President Hughes, in which I and others of you participated. Our task force essentially recommended some ways that additional flexibility can be built into the residential urban growth management process. Along with that flexibility, we also recommended that cities should have an opportunity to make their case for proposed expansions, and we laid out some overarching thoughts on topics that cities should address. We suggested that developing more clarity on what makes for a good proposal, and staff has been working with MTAC, our technical committee, on that. MPAC is scheduled to make a formal recommendation on code amendments to the Metro Council on October 11th. Tonight we'll have an update and a brief discussion. This will be introduced by Ted Reed, Metro Principal Regional Planner.
I believe my boss, Alyssa, has a few comments first. But.
Hi there. I think most of you already know Ted Reed, who leads our growth management work, but if you don't, get used to seeing him. This is the part of your MPAC time where we're going to start really talking about a growth management decision that is going to happen next year. So if you thought MPAC was boring, this is the part you come for. And so I just wanted to make sure that you all sort of realize that we're at a kickoff phase of what is going to lead to ultimately an MPAC recommendation to the Metro Council around the urban growth boundary. So this is kind of the fun part. part. As Ted will go into, we've been having a long conversation about what this growth management cycle looks like. Our last conversation about this was 3 years ago in 2015, and the council can speak to sort of why we've decided to go ahead and do it again in 2018 and what that means going forward. But this is a moment in time in the growth management conversation that has evolved over many years, and so we're excited to actually begin a longer conversation about where we go from here. So that's all I really had to say.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Gamba and IMPACT members. I am here to talk to you about some of the ways that we are attempting to evolve the region's urban growth management system. This is based on discussions that this group has had, that various stakeholders have had, that the council has had over the years, a real desire to change how these processes go. So I'm going to take you down a trip down memory lane.
Some of us would rather forget.
This is not my first rodeo.
This is the way that you get past the pain, is to live through it again. I'm not able to get the slides to advance with this.
I will gladly sit in the chair and
thank you. I think we can have someone else do it, Councillor Harrington. Okay, so some of the pain that you've lived through in the past. The old system really began with this theoretical numeric approach where we defined complex housing needs using some relatively simple math. Thank you. And it led to theoretical debates about those numbers, and many people felt like they didn't have an opportunity to talk about the things they actually care about, how to actually get housing built, how to build the kinds of housing that people need that matches their incomes and their life stages. And then that numeric calculation led to expansions of the urban growth boundary based on soil types. And essentially, if land was no good for agriculture, then that was the land we looked at for expansions. And often, those same lands with poor soil quality were also difficult to develop. They had steep topography and other issues. And then, as a last step, we would have the city or the county go through this concept planning process. So we've made the expansion, and now the city and county would be responsible for figuring out what to do with the land. And often that led to community concerns about what's going to change, traffic impacts, who's going to pay for the infrastructure, and is there a city there to govern the area, or is it going to be a county responsibility? And so this old process was frustrating to many people, and that what we are trying to do is improve how we do these things. Okay. And the history goes back a ways. In 2006, some of you were around for this. We had a regional process called the New Look at Regional Choices. And a couple of things that this process looked at were that we needed to identify urban and rural reserves, one thing. Where are we willing to grow and where are we not willing to grow into the future? And that we should also shift the debate away from that new numbers debate towards an outcomes-based approach. So some history going back 11 years here. And we took that direction to heart. Of course, in 1994, predating the New Look, we as a region worked together to define where we were going to grow with the 2040 growth concept. And then in 2010, the three counties and metro agreed on urban and rural reserves. And again, in 2017, after some litigation and remands, those urban and rural reserves were adopted again. We also, as a region, had a discussion about how we needed to have a plan before expanding the urban growth boundary. Since 2006, Metro has been funding these planning efforts with a grant program. It's now called 2040 Planning and Development Grants. You may know it as the Community Planning and Development Grant Program. in its earlier iterations. And in 2010, Council with Impacts Advice adopted code language that required that we want to see a concept plan for an expansion area before it gets added to the urban growth boundary. So deal with those issues of infrastructure funding, what kind of housing are you planning for, who's going to govern it before we expand. And then we also had more discussion about this outcomes-based approach. Some of you were here in 2009 when we began talking about what we meant by desired outcomes. In 2009, Council with Impact Advice expressed its intent to make decisions based on six desired outcomes. That was further codified in 2010 by the Council adopting changes to the regional framework plan based on impacts advice, again, that spelled out what those six desired outcomes were, and again, the intent that those were going to guide urban growth management decisions. And we haven't fully implemented that program yet, but that's the intent going forward, starting in the 2018 urban growth management decision. During the last decision in 2015, the Council with impacts advice expressed an interest in finding ways to improve our process. And one of those things was to get back to that outcomes-based approach and really kind of flesh out what that's going to look like in decision making. As a consequence of getting that direction from the Council in 2015, Council President Hughes convened an Urban Growth Readiness Task Force. As Mayor Gamba mentioned, some of you participated in that task force. And it was really intended to identify ways that the region could have more flexibility to respond to city proposals for residential expansions. And then the flip side of that flexibility in responding to cities is, of course, that cities are going to want to know what those expectations are. How can they meet the bar that the council is setting? So have that discussion up front of what a good proposal looks like. And the task force, again, returned to those six desired outcomes: housing affordability, likelihood of development, and demonstration that you're taking efforts in your existing urban areas. Those are the things the task force identified as things that we should clarify as expectations. The council endorsed the task force's unanimous recommendations and asked us to work with the Metro Technical Advisory Committee to turn this into proposed code language. That's what you have in your packet tonight, is the results of MTAC's work for the last year to develop some code language. And so, old system, we talked about this a moment ago. New system, I think I'm jumping the gun on pushing the button here. Again, urban-rural reserves are the first step for the region. We've agreed on where we are willing to grow and where we're not willing to grow for the next five decades. We're seeking state acknowledgement of those designations this fall. The next step, of course, is that we want to assist in concept planning those urban reserves before they get added to the urban growth boundary. As I mentioned, we have a grant funding program to pay for those local planning efforts. And then this last step is primarily what MTAC has been talking about. Decide whether proposed expansions are needed based on the outcomes they produce. And that's what is behind the code language in your packet. MTAC made some unanimous recommendations on this code language at their, I believe, September 6th meeting. Again, the intent was to clarify expectations for cities, but MTAC also had a lot of discussion about what's the proper balance between clarifying expectations and still allowing for some flexibility. And they dealt with that tension quite a bit over the last year, trying out different versions of code and sometimes finding that the draft was too prescriptive, and again returning to flexibility. And so where they ended up is that these expectations should apply to all residential urban growth boundary expansion decisions going forward, but there should be a higher bar for mid-cycle decisions. This is a mid-cycle process that was enabled by legislation that was passed into state law this last legislative session. And the idea there is that if you're going through the special mid-cycle process, that you should have a more rigorous approach to those expectations, meeting those expectations. So the things that IMTAC landed on that you'll find in your code are they suggest that we should see coordination of the local housing needs analysis with regional forecasts. That a city should demonstrate the likelihood of development of the expansion area, that a city should demonstrate they've been making their best efforts in their existing urban areas, increasing walkability and transit supportive development, that they are undertaking best practices in their existing urban areas to encourage the development and preservation of affordable housing, and that they are advancing the 6 desired outcomes. Recognizing that there's still some flexibility in all of this, IMTAC also suggested that we develop some administrative guidance to give a bit more direction on what we mean by these things. This is my last slide, and then we'll open it up to discussion. Just wanted to briefly touch on the next steps for this. You're having an initial discussion tonight of the proposed code amendments. And we are scheduled to have IMPACT provide a formal recommendation on October 11th. And then that will move to council consideration of these code amendments on October 26th and November 2nd. And then the rest of the process going forward after that for the growth management decision is that we are looking for letters of interest from cities that want to propose residential or employment expansions by the end of this calendar year. We have been working with a number of your staff and other technical experts to undertake the technical work we have to do to complete a forecast and buildable land inventory. That work will continue through the spring. End of May 2018 is when we want to see full proposals from cities that want to advocate for expansion. So that would be a concept plan for the urban reserve, as well as addressing the criteria that are in your packet as proposed code amendments. End of June, we're going to release our regional analysis that we call the Urban Growth Report, along with those city proposals for UGB expansions. Which leads to this group and council having some discussions next summer about the merits of those proposals. And we really hope to move the discussion away from that abstract debate that has been frustrating to many people in the past towards a discussion of the merits of city proposals. Culminating in IMPACT advice to the council next fall and a council decision by the end of 2018.
What I mean by you're going to be seeing a lot of Ted?
Under this process, we'd be asking community members to engage in a planning process, but there isn't at that point any certainty that there's going to be an expansion. So how is that tension going to be dealt with so that people feel like it's worth their while to put in the effort? But in fact, they don't know at that point whether they're going to get an expansion or not.
Well, that's something that has come up repeatedly, Commissioner, and I think it's sort of the tension of shifting away from expansion before planning towards planning and then expansion. It's the trade-off that goes along with that. As I mentioned, we do have a grant funding program to help with some of that resource that the planning requires. But it does require some initiative on the part of the city to do this. And there are a few mayors around the table that may be thinking about expansion proposals next go around. Maybe they have a perspective on Mayor Calloway.
I'm not sure who is up first over here.
Okay. Back in March, when I was starting my first rodeo, we had a presentation. It was a 2018 Urban Growth Management Decision Work Program Overview, if that sounds familiar. So I was curious if, what we got, what was presented in March, if there's any differences between the March, presentation, PowerPoint information, and what we received.
No, the,
I don't mean to put you on the spot with that.
If members are interested, we did provide a copy of that work program on the table as new material. As Mayor Calloway mentioned, this is the work program that the council endorsed in February that we brought to MPAC in March, and it lays out a process for working with MTAC to develop these expectations as proposed code language with the intent that these would be in effect for the 2018 urban growth management decision.
Thanks, Ted. Just a point of clarification. So on the new system, under the previous slide, you've got concept plan, urban reserve areas before expansion. I think that's a great idea. I think that would have certainly helped the city of Damascus, of course, before it was Damascus. It was boring. It was unincorporated. But that's the question I have is on an incorporated city, of course, the city would have skin of the game in creating that concept plan, which before would actually be approved, it would have that part of it identified. But in an unincorporated area like Damascus was, if we were to go back in time and this new process was in place, how would that have rolled out? Who would have created that concept plan?
Right. Well, I think that is certainly one of the lessons that the region learned, is that it's difficult to create a large new city.
Yeah, didn't work so well.
And so I think going forward, what we're more likely to see is existing cities proposing expansions to their jurisdiction.
Right. As I understood it, the midterm expansions could only be requested by cities. Isn't that
correct?
The deal.
Correct.
So if something like a Damascus were to be considered ever again in the history of humanity, it would have to be on the not midterm.
This would be the safety net from going down that same road again. Gotcha. Okay, thank you.
I think it's required all the time. We codified that in 2010.
Right.
So it is. Okay, good.
It has to be a adjacent city. Municipal government, is that?
It has to be concept planned, which of course requires an entity to adopt a concept plan. I know that the counties are keenly interested in getting out of the urban services business. So they're looking to cities to take the lead in that effort.
Betty?
Oh, I was just going to say, after Jerry's comment, I was happy to read on that the UGB amendment criterion was changed from 20 years to 10 years so that you could be more responsive to changes. I think that's really important. But I had a question earlier where it said that council direction was to work towards a state acknowledgement of urban and rural reserves now adopted by Metro and the county's impending state acknowledgement. So I wondered what the status was of that.
It was submitted to the state this summer, and we, of course, have Carrie here that can provide a bit more detail. I believe the hearings are scheduled before the commission in November, but I guess I'll turn it over to you.
If I could speak to that really quickly. So it's currently under review by the department. Our hope is that we will be able to have that processed in a timely manner such that we can hold hearings at our November meeting, which is actually going to be held in Florence, if anyone wants to travel, Roger. If we aren't able to do that for some reason, it will be the hearings will be held before our commission in January. So we're trying to fast track it as much as we can, and that's why our aim is to hold the hearings this November.
So that'll work with the timeline for the code amendments.
If things go as we
assuming,
hope. Yes. But all of this does hang on urban and rural reserves being finalized and acknowledged.
Mm-hmm. You, Carrie.
So Portland obviously is landlocked, so we won't be doing any expansions up here. But I'm curious how it works in other jurisdictions. If we annex an individual property or a street, that has to be a vote of the city council, but not a vote of the people. What's the difference between the annexation process and the UGB expansion?
Some cities in our urban area have voter-approved annexation, so the city council can't just do it. That would, outside the areas, North Plains. Oregon City has voter-approved annexation, Sherwood.
That was reversed.
The state reversed that. It's no longer, there aren't any cities anymore that require
legislation. There's 100% approval of the property owners in the area that's to be annexed.
Yeah.
But if there isn't, then it reverts to the voter-approved annexation.
It might, I don't know.
That I'm not sure.
I'm just wondering how that all, just thinking about how would I put that together and how would I encourage people to participate in a process. I understand that the staff would get grant from Metro, but, would we have community members engaging whether to do it rather than how to do it at this early stage?
Well, our hope is that as cities undertake the concept planning process, they have robust community engagement in those community planning efforts, so there are fewer surprises down the line.
But in the midterm annex, it would be counted as an annexation and there would have to be 100% approval or a vote?
I'm going to turn to my land use attorney here to clarify some of the annexation requirements.
Yes. Hi, everyone. I'm not sure, so I may not be tracking the question exactly. So it's are we talking about after the UGB has been expanded and then how does the annexation happen after that?
If in the past when we've expanded the UGB, the individual property owners don't get to vote, and the city council doesn't vote on it either, right? And except for conceptual support. In this process, midterm, do the property owners all have to agree? And if not, how does the Metro and or the city proceed in that case?
Okay, got it. Well, so the criteria, the new code language that we've proposed does include some extensive notice requirements. So we do not typically in a UGB expansion actually require approval of the property owners who are coming into the UGB, but they are notified and they are provided a opportunity to participate in the entire process.
So this is more like a UGB expansion, not an annexation.
Nothing else?
So the city would be doing the proposing, so essentially the governing body of the city would be deciding we think we should expand here, and then it would be up to them to persuade the people, both who are affected and also everybody else, to get together and figure out how to do it.
That's the idea.
Is that it?
That's it.
Yeah. And I think, as Ted mentioned, we imagine that process would include a lot of outreach to property owners, community members, as far as being engaged in adopting a concept plan and deciding what it should look like.
I think it's important, too, that the wording in the amendment says that any expansion under that section mid-cycle can't exceed a total of 1,000 acres. So we're not talking about grabbing huge chunks, little bits at a time.
So Hillsborough supports the amendments and thanks you for all the work. I was wondering if I could go in a slightly different tack. It's related to UGB expansion, but it's not on our agenda tonight. Okay. On the 14th, September 14th, Metro received the draft document titled Administrative Guidance for Cities Proposing Residential Urban Growth Boundary Expansion in the 2018 Urban Growth Management Decision, and it'll be the document that provides guidance for cities making residential expansion, proposals. But from what we understand, neither MPAC or MTAC will have opportunity to weigh in on the guiding document before jurisdictions who are requesting an expansion are required to respond to them. So would it be possible for the document to be reviewed by MTAC and MPAC prior to going to Metro Council for final approval? Process is entirely new for this expansion cycle, and I think it would be helpful for us to be able to hear concerns and questions from cities that are moving forward. And typically, again, it's still my first rodeo, but it seems like we have that opportunity for input on policies and those new directions.
The administrative guidance.
In MTAC's discussions, as they proposed the code in your packet, they recognized that cities that were trying to address the code probably still had some questions about how to do that effectively. So they suggested that staff work to develop administrative guidance and to clarify, there's no intention that administrative guidance gets adopted by the Metro Council. It's something that can be a document that changes with each decision to get smarter, essentially, as we figure out what works and what doesn't work. Hopefully there are no surprises in that administrative guidance. It's really framed around the code language that you have in front of you, really trying to illuminate that a bit more rather than creating new policy or different policy.
Are there proposed administrative guidance information now?
There was a draft of it in the council work session packet. Councillor, you weren't able to attend that work session.
But I'm just wondering, so it sounds like city staff has received it. Is it possible for that to be sent to the MPAC body as well?
We can certainly do that. I guess it's a question of how formal do we want MPAC's discussion to be around it. Of course, we have...
I'm just asking that it be shared.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right, and I think the idea is similar to grant applications where a city might say, all right, I would like to apply for a grant that has the following criteria. We then provide also a handbook for applicants, like here's what a successful grant would have in it. Here are the elements that the Metro Council would want to see. And so I think that we're sort of modeling it on a sort of similar tool. So instead of being a prescriptive thing where Metro is telling cities what they have to do, it's providing guidance on how to create something that will be successful through the new process. So as Ted says, each time we learn it, since this is actually all of our first rodeo this way, it's a document that can change as we evolve the program further. So it's intended to be a guidance tool, and we're happy to share the guidance with anybody who'd like to see the guidance. Okay.
Thank you. Anybody else? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll be back again October 11th to seek the group's formal recommendation.
Thank you.
All right. Item 6.2 is housing trends and policies around the region, Hillsborough and Portland. This item is for information and discussion. When MPAC made a recommendation to the Metro Council during the 2015 Urban Growth Management Decision, we suggested ongoing dialogue and reporting about how the region is growing. Tonight's topic is part of that ongoing dialogue. We will be talking about these kinds of topics more over the next year as we prepare to make recommendation to the Council on its next urban growth management decision. Tonight we are joined by planning staff from the cities of Portland and Hillsborough. They will provide an overview of some of the housing trends, challenges, opportunities, policies, and investments in their city. On October 11th, we hope to hear from Clackamas County and Milwaukee staff. On October 25th, we hope to hear from the staff of Beaverton and Wilsonville. Tonight we'll be hearing from Tom Armstrong from the city of Portland and Colin Cooper in the city of Hillsborough, maybe.
Colin, are you going to go up?
Are you going to
I'm going first.
You're
going to
solo
first.
And then turn it over to Colin.
All right.
Colin, and try not to use all his time up. Wow. So I have an overview here of what the city of Portland has been up to, and I'm starting with, we have spent the last 8 years updating our comprehensive plan, and it is also at the state awaiting acknowledgement before it becomes hopefully effective in spring of 2018. You know, it looks a lot like the Region 2040 plan in that we're looking to focus a lot of our growth in centers and corridors. We are planning about 30% of our residential growth in the central city and 50% of the growth in our centers and corridors, with the other 20% sort of spread out across the in-between areas. Also a big part of our comp plan is this idea of a healthy connected city, or complete neighborhoods, or 20-minute neighborhoods, where most, if not all, of our residents can find most of what they need on a daily basis within a 20-minute walk, bike ride, transit ride. We've set a goal of 80% of Portland households to be in one of these connected neighborhoods. We currently are about 65%. It's an interesting dynamic. We've looked at both, you know, where we grow, and that'll get us part of the way to our goal, but it's also the idea of investing in infrastructure and parks and bikeways and transit that'll get us, that we need to create more of these complete neighborhoods in order to get us to our 80% goal. Oh, there's our centers and corridors. And so housing affordability and housing costs have been a big issue for us coming out of the recession. We've seen, you know, as many cities across the country, a demand for close-in housing. This is a chart of sales prices of homes in 2016, with the white and yellow and orange areas being the more expensive parts of town, and the blue and purple being more affordable. Since 2007, we've seen the median sales price go up by about 13%. Median incomes have risen only about 9%. So they're lagging a little bit there. However, in terms of rents, we've seen rents go up by 25 to 29%. So the rental market is far outstripping the incomes. And so that is one of the things that has contributed to the affordability and the increased displacement that we've been seeing from the inner neighborhoods to East Portland and the other parts of the region. Another way of looking at this is a map of home value sales in 2008, and what was affordable to a household that earned 120% of the median family income, which I think is around $65,000-ish. So the areas in blue were affordable back then. The areas in red and yellow had very few homes that were priced in that affordable range. And then when we jump ahead to 2016, you can see that inner neighborhood really turns unaffordable. And, you know, for a long time we've thought, at least in the city of Portland, we've thought about waves of going out in terms of where we're seeing the demand and also seeing the construction in terms of radiating out from the central city and really looking at that and what you see here, sort of 3 miles from the central city being that easy bus ride or that easy bike ride into all of the jobs in the central city. And so you really see that. The other interesting thing when we look at this is that you still have quite a bit of affordability, at least in terms of home sales, in the central city and in the sort of South McAdam area because of the condos being more affordable in that range. This is a map that also shows that, is that the areas in yellow and red have seen the most change in terms of becoming the most unaffordable, whereas you see more stability in East Portland and far north Portland, St. John's, Lombard area, just as a way of, you know, how they've changed from 2008 to 2016. In terms of permits, we've seen robust growth, especially since 2013, but since 2007-08. We've added about 60,000 people to the city of Portland and about 29,000 units. So that's a little bit, you know, just slightly over 2 people per unit. The citywide average is about 2.3 per unit. So lagging a little bit on that population growth in terms of providing enough supply. But the other thing that we've seen in that time period, which I think also contributes to the housing affordability, is the growth in high-wage jobs. Jobs earning more than, $56,000 a year. And the fact that our recovery of job growth since 2008 has been mostly in, and this is a regional number, but has been really on the high end. And so you have a lot more people with a lot more money walking around in their pocket bidding up the cost of housing. So combining the lagging production with a lot more money is really where we think we've seen the pressure, especially in the close-in neighborhoods. This is a graph of our permit activity. The gray areas on top are our multi-family units. The blue areas on the bottom are the single-family units. And as you can see, you know, for the last 3 years, we've been producing over 5,000 units per year, which is a pretty high-level sustained growth. Our Bureau of Development Services is constantly short of planning review staff and constantly hiring people to keep up with that demand. The little sliver down here at the bottom, that dark blue sliver that begins to pop up, those are ADU permits. And when the recession hit, the city decided to waive the SDCs on ADUs, which is about a $15,000 charge per unit. And we saw in that period the ADUs really take off to where we're permitting, I think, 400 to 500 units per year in that category. So you really begin to see that notch up.
I might just interject, though, it's not quite clear whether those are all new units for residents to live in or whether some of them are being Airbnbs.
Right, and also some of them were informal apartments before, and they are now coming in and getting legalized as well.
I don't want to belabor ADUs too much, but I was at a presentation this morning for the Columbia Corridor Association, and a developer who develops a number of ADUs, Eli Spivak, was there speaking. And one of the things that he raised about ADUs reflective to affordable housing is they may be a more affordable option, but right now, because of financing mechanisms and whatnot, they don't really seem to be going in, or certainly by middle-income people are not putting them in their homes. I'm wondering if the city has mapped where those ADU permits at all, and are they going into areas where we'd like to see increased housing stock, or what's the dispersion of
right.
location of those?
We have. I don't know what that map looks like. My impression from what I've seen in some recent survey data, I think that the Build Small Coalition had done as part of their tour, is my impression it gets used. The ADUs are being used for a lot of different purposes. Short-term rentals, long-term rentals, caregivers, extra room in the house for visiting family. It's quite flexible space. But I do know that coalition is looking at the financing and how to ease that. We actually have a CET grant or planning and development grant to explore that for areas like in Cully and how we can boost that as both a housing option and as a wealth creation option. And we're exploring, Prosper Portland is exploring doing a similar thing in the north-northeast area for long-term homeowners as a way of providing some low-cost financing so that they could build an ADU in their backyard.
Well, and Tom, the city has a program as well, which the name is escaping me right now. It's sort of experimental about homeowners putting ADUs in their yards to house homeless folks.
That's a county program that
that's
they're trying
the county,
to,
okay.
to get off the ground as part of their strategy as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if it happens in the county, but it's also Portland, you have oversight over the...
Yeah, all of the ADU permits would have to come through us. It's a financing mechanism to try and, you know, I think the way the county's looking at it is that if you let us house a homeless family there for 5 years, then you get the unit free and clear after that time period. And they've done the math that finds that it's cost effective. So,
and there's no difference in permitting.
No, they would still have to go through. But presumably the county program would come with some standard plans and assistance to navigate that process and the construction process.
Okay. Thank you.
This is a map of the permit locations and where we're seeing it. And, you know, again, lots of activity in the central city and in the inner neighborhoods. And over the last 5 years, we're actually sort of hitting our numbers in the central city and the centers and corridors in terms of our long-term growth management plan. And, you know, almost 80% of the units are multifamily, which is mirrors what our capacity is. As a built-out city, we, you know, most of our development, residential development, is going to be through infill and redevelopment of previously built sites, and we really are focusing on those centers and corridors. In terms of affordable housing and sort of affordable housing for lower income households, 80% or below or 60% median family income or below, we have a couple of different strategies that we've really ramped up over the last few years. First of all, on the funding front, last November we got voter approval for a $258 million bond with a target of 1,300 units affordable at 60% MFI level and below. In addition to that, we've earmarked 45% now, is it, Commissioner, of the urban renewal funds in our urban renewal funds, 45% of those resources is dedicated to affordable housing. We've earmarked our Airbnb short-term rental lodging tax revenue, which is coming in at about $1 million a year for affordable housing. And then as part of the inclusionary housing legislation, that also authorized cities to pass a construction excise tax. And we passed one last July that was effective August 1st. It's 1% tax on both commercial and residential development that's being earmarked for affordable housing, and we are estimating that'll bring in another $8 to $9 million a year that will go that's being managed by the Portland Housing Bureau in terms of funding affordable housing projects. In addition to that, we've looked at renter protections. And we've provided some both longer notice in terms of no-cause evictions and rent increases over 5% in any given year. We've also adopted a requirement for relocation assistance in those cases of no-cause evictions or rent increases. That relocation assistance is based on unit size and ranges from $3,000 to $4,500 per unit that the landlords have to pay to the tenants if they're increasing the rent by more than 10%. Yeah.
On your short-term rental lodging tax in Portland, is that
apart from your regular transient lodging tax, the state the state tax, so to speak, or
yes.
Okay, so that's an addition too.
Yes.
And is that only on Airbnb, VRBO, not on hotel rooms?
Right.
Okay.
Correct.
Thanks.
And then finally, last year we adopted an inclusionary housing program. If you'll recall, in early 2016, the legislature began discussions and considering legislation to lift the preemption on local governments adopting these programs. We moved our pieces in place, and so when that legislation passed in March, we started our legislative process with an advisory committee and some technical analysis, such that we were able to adopt a program by the end of December of 2016, and it was effective as of February 1st of this year. Per the state legislation, this applies to all buildings with more than 20 units. That's a significant technical detail. And one of the issues is if you have a site with multiple buildings coming in at 19 units, that would be a loophole. We haven't seen a lot of that activity yet, and I'll get into some of that coming up. We have adopted a pretty complex program in terms of trying to incentivize the building of units, especially those that are affordable at 60% of the area median income. So we have a lower inclusion rate at 10%. If you go for that deeper affordability, we have a range of incentives that go from density bonuses to various fee waivers to parking requirement exemptions. We have also other provisions where you can provide the units off-site, either by constructing new units or preserving existing sort of market rate affordable units. The affordability period is for 99 years, so it's essentially permanently affordable. And we also have the option to pay a fee in lieu, but we've purposely set that fee in lieu on the high side. It's $20 to $30 per square foot, depending on what zone you're in. And because we want and we think that the private developers can build the units more affordably rather than us taking the time to collect all the money, get enough money to do a project, have it erode over time. Yes, ma'am?
So is this just on for sale units?
No, this is all units.
How do you track keeping the rents affordable?
Well, we do that. We our housing bureau already has a program because we already have a affordable housing tax exemption program, and also have for any funding that we put into other projects. So they already have an administrative setup and staffing. So there's annual reporting on the part of the property building owner to sort of provide evidence and demonstrate what the incomes are of the residents of those units over time. So there's an annual reporting mechanism.
Is that required of all rental units in the city?
All affordable units where we have public dollars into them.
Well, so it sort of getting back to some of your other steps that you've taken around. You know, if the rent increases more than 10% in a year or whatever it was, they had to pay. How do you verify that if you're not already tracking?
That's sort of a civil matter. So it's up to the tenant to file a complaint or an action through the Housing Bureau that, hey, you know, they didn't do this right. So there is... a lot of it is sort of complaint-based, and we've worked with the Community Alliance of Tenants and other groups to make sure that information is known and out in the community, so there's an awareness of that.
The relocation and the notice thing is very much a work in progress. We're hoping to have an Office of Landlord Tenant Affairs or something like that as it goes. But the tax exemption one has been going, as was said, we've done those for many years. And pretty much every year we get a report saying that these properties are being struck off the exemption because they're no longer affordable. So they do go check.
Have you guys looked into the possibility of requiring landlords report the rents in their various units?
I think that's been contemplated. Previously, we haven't done very much on this at all, except for the ones that have tax abatements.
Right.
We've thought about it. We haven't actually moved forward with any sort of proposal like that.
There's obviously a lot of things to consider so that you don't have unintended consequences. I do want to just say that I'm so excited. 3 hours ago, we passed the first three under the inclusionary zoning projects. Mm-hmm. We were wondering whether we'd get any at all, because right before the deadline they got 18,000 permit applications, which is three times the annual rate, many of them thrown in on the back of napkin to stop the clock. So I was thinking I'd be long gone before I got any of them. But we have three today, so 23 units total. Most of them at 80%, but some at 60%. And the cost to us as the taxing jurisdiction is $74 a month total. Okay. So in terms of because the tax abatement is only for 10 years, the affordability goes along, but because what's really great is these projects are mixed income projects, so they know that they're going to make enough on the higher rental properties to help subsidize the lower ones. So it's, in that sense, just on the first three, it's working exactly as we hoped it would.
Commissioner?
Yes, thank you. And Tommy, you know, we've been working on a preservation program I have in District 2 to be able to put at least 30 percentile units on the ground immediately. And I talked to you a bit about that too, Betty, where we would actually use the tax abatement for existing multiplexes. And we could do that abatement for up to 10 years, 15 years, but as a pilot project. And we would, of course, need the City of Portland to approve that. And when we were working on it, Commissioner Saltzman was the housing bureau person, and then we had to start all over again. But, you know, I'm still working on this project to make sure that we have some of our most vulnerable folks able to get housing, because it takes anywhere between 4 to 6 years from pre-development all the way to development to get, you know, affordable housing. If we can use our existing stock and give the older units that abatement, we could put folks in housing like yesterday. So this is a thing that I've been pitching with the city commissioners and with the Multnomah County commissioners, so that we can move some of these folks who are in transitional housing and temporary housing into permanent housing.
Yeah, as Commissioner Fritz mentioned, you know, one of the key concerns was this bundle of incentives, how did that offset the cost of providing and building the units? And that's one of the things that we're tracking over time. We did get flooded with almost 19,000 units before the February 1st deadline. And so we're tracking that progress. We just did a six-month review of the building permits, and they are moving through the system. You know, we see about 5,000 units moving through the system, getting their building permits, moving forward. As Commissioner Fritz mentioned, we just approved three projects under the inclusionary program. There's three more out there. So there was this cliff of activity that happened after February 1st, and just now we're starting to see the market respond. We're seeing more requests for pre-application conferences. We're seeing more activity. So we need to work through this backlog in order to see that the market fully uptake that. And the other thing that we're exploring is, can we offer a similar bundle, especially in terms of fee waivers and tax exemptions, to those existing projects that are in line, get them to jump out of, get out of line and get under the program and provide those units so that we can leverage some of that development as well.
Tom, what the folks that you have in the queue right now, when will they be available? Will they be available in the next 4 years, 5 years, 6 years?
So as in the queue, they have 3 years from the time that they applied to go through the process and firm up.
To begin, but they don't have to complete them in 3 years.
I think they have to have a building permit issued.
A building permit, but not necessarily fully developed out.
Not fully developed and built out. And as long as they're doing some work on that permit, they can keep building that out. But by the time you get a permit issued, you're fully committed.
You're fully committed to it. And again, what I'm saying is that as we're doing this, and I think it's not just one, you know, process. I think we need to be working on several at the same time.
Yeah.
Betty?
So I was just going to say, I happen to sit on PHAC, Portland Housing Advisory Committee, and at our last meeting we were presented with a document that showed the number of permitted projects under coming up under inclusionary housing. And as I recall, there were 13 projects, five of which were publicly funded, so had Bureau funding in them. Roughly 800 and some odd units, and 81 of those units were going to be at the 60%, so they were hitting the 10% mark. So we were really happy to see that moving along, and especially the ones that didn't have public subsidy in them, the private developers.
Yeah.
One note to add, before this, 95% of the multifamily units that were being built were luxury apartments. Yeah. So that's one of the things that we really needed to have this program is, you know, as Tom pointed out at the beginning of the presentation, people are moving in with much higher incomes, and so they're able to pay sky-high prices, and people who've been here for a long time can't.
So I'm curious, so that I know that the state law was the 20% at 80. Did you guys have to work a special deal to get the 10% at 60? Or
the 10% at 60 is a voluntary program. That's why we set it at a lower rate, is to encourage developers to take that up. What they have to do is 20 at 80. But the legislation is broad enough that we can... basically, the legislation says you have to do 20 at 80, and you have to offer a package of incentives, and you have to offer a fee in lieu. And so we developed these other options, such as the off-site option, and sort of this deeper affordability level. But those are voluntary, so we're trying to provide a menu of choices there.
And Gretchen has a question. Is there any plan to address need for housing at the 30 to 50% median income?
So not necessarily through the inclusionary housing program, but this allows us to take our financial resources and really target it that, you know, at the 30 and below and the 60 and below levels. Finally, I'm going to close. You know, we are still doing planning and looking at increasing the development capacity in the city. Currently, before City Council is an update to our Central City Plan. In there, one of the features in there is we do make some adjustments to our floor area ratios and to the heights allowed in on this graphic. The blue areas are areas where we're actually lowering heights, and that's primarily to protect scenic views and in historic districts. And in the beige areas are where we're increasing heights as high as 450, 460 feet in those parts of town. And that is currently before City Council as we work our way through that process. We are also looking at, and I think I've talked to you before about our residential infill project, which is really looking at our single family neighborhoods, and this was coming out of both concerns about increased home demolitions and what replaces them being large, more expensive, different housing that's out of scale with the character of the neighborhood. At the same time, we've seen a push for more middle housing options, and so we've combined those two efforts to look at limiting the size of houses to, I think it's 2,500 square feet above grade, and then also looking at options for allowing, currently the city allows duplexes on corner lots and one ADU, and we're looking at options in areas where we might allow duplexes on interior lots, a second ADU, so you could have one in the basement and one over your garage, or triplexes on corners. But those options all have to fit within that 2,500 square foot box. So keeping the scale, but allowing more creative use of that box. These expanded options would really be sort of in a limited area. This area in green represents the areas that are close to transit and other amenities like local neighborhood shopping districts and parks and schools. It represents about 50% of the single-family lots in Portland. We have a big exemption down here in the southeast corner, which is the David Douglas School District, where we have some school capacity issues. So we've made some moves there, not at least in the short term, to encourage a lot of new development there to just pile on to the overcapacity issues that they have. Again, this is actually a proposal that we are publishing on Monday, and we'll go to our Planning and Sustainability Commission later this year and to the City Council next spring. We're also looking with a grant from Metro at rewriting our multi-dwelling zones. The big change there is we're looking at going from sort of a density units per acre model and looking at one that's more scale-based, so looking at the size of the box, the floor area ratio and the height, but allowing more flexibility on the types of units within there. This example is on the left, is sort of our typical, what we call our R1 zone for a typical site. I think this is 15,000 square feet site. We're often seeing a lot of townhouses packed in there. But if you look at the older development on our corridors, like you see along Hawthorne or Vancouver Williams, the older buildings, they're more like the building on the right, small apartment buildings. And so we're looking at providing flexibility on the development side, same sort of size box, same 45-foot height limit, but much more flexibility on how you organize what goes into the box. And again, that's a proposal that we're currently working on and will be sort of moving forward our adoption process in 2018. And that's what I have for you this evening.
Thank you. All right, so Colin.
Good evening. Colin Cooper, Planning Director. Good to see everybody representing the City of Hillsborough and my mayor, Mayor Calloway. And
So I'm going to have kind of a fly through Hillsborough, a little different presentation than Tom gave you, but I think it'll be informative and interesting. And I think that because we sit in Portland here at MPACT, that a lot of you know about the geography. So I always start with the first slide here is that Hillsborough is off on the western side of the region. It's approximately 10 miles from where we sit here in downtown Portland to our eastern boundary, and it was a city that's founded in 1850 and incorporated in 1876 and has been the seat of the Washington County government ever since then. I often describe Hillsborough as a small city that's suburbanized. Some people would see Hillsborough just as a suburb, and indeed we are a suburb of the larger Portland area, but we have a very proud agricultural history as an independent city. It was the commercial hub of the upper Tualatin Valley, so I always like to sort of couch it in those terms. So we've been growing for a long time pretty steadily, and so I've just provide this graph this evening just looking back to 1990, where our population of our city was about 36,000 people. I'm mostly going to look at numbers today relative to housing jobs from post-recession, so from 2010 to 2016 is the period of time that I'll talk about. So when we look at our 2010 population, so again, 1990, approximately 37,000 people. 2010, our city has grown to 91,000. people. Today, last year our official population was 99,340, and I would dare say that we've tipped the scale to six figures at this point. And if we look at the number of units in 1990 of housing, we had 13,000 units. In 2010, we had 33,000 units of housing. And now in 2016 we're up to 37,000 units.
Question: why is there a spike in 2035?
In
2035, does it, suddenly the population starts taking off?
I would say that there's a variety. That's an interesting question, Councillor Fritz, and the. I can't tell you specifically why that takes off. I think our projections are that we will continue to densify in the growth areas in our regional centers in Amberglen, as well as our downtown regional center, and we also have a significant amount of employment areas, so we think those jobs and housing numbers will go. So that's a fair question, and I'll try to find somebody to contact you and get back to you on that.
But I'll clarify, it's not because that's when I can no longer be mayor. That could be a logical assumption.
Doesn't South Hillsborough play into that, though?
South Hillsborough does, and I'll be talking into South Hillsborough. But I think, candidly, South Hillsborough is going to be largely built out by 2035. So,
Mr. Cooper, those housing units, are those defined as both multifamily and single family?
Yes, they are. Yeah, absolutely. And so who are the people of Hillsborough currently? We have a median household income of $67,000 as a median household income, which is higher than the regional average and higher than our county average. We are slightly younger households generally, and we're also slightly larger. And we know that those will change, will grow older like the rest of the region, and our households will shrink somewhat, but we are seeing a lot of young people still coming out to our part of the region for the jobs that are available, the schools that are available, and the quality of life that the city of Hillsborough provides. And as you can see in this graph, we have a lot of people in the $100,000 per year household income or greater. The number of jobs that we had in 2010, Tom talked about that, and we don't keep up with Portland, which has, of course, become a very attractive place for many of the technology software companies, but we still have a very, very strong jobs base. In 2010, it was 55,000. We've added approximately 13,000 jobs since 2010, and so we have now in 2015, I'm sorry, I don't have a newer number, of 68,039. Of those 68,000 jobs, approximately 45,000 of those are in advanced manufacturing, and those are the jobs at places like Intel and Jira and
and Corvo and all of the high-tech manufacturing, and those have an average job benefit package of $157,000 per job. We're also very proud to be a very diverse community. And we have 61% Caucasian and so 39% non-Caucasian, a significant Hispanic population, but a growing population from other parts of the world. And so we're very proud of that, and we embrace that very strongly, and a very strong educational attainment. So now let's talk about housing. That's Hillsborough. Unless there are any questions, we'll go to housing. So like Portland, since 2010, we've seen most of our housing stock be in multifamily. So it's 70%, in fact. And so slightly less than what Tom reported at 77%, but not unlike, I think, most of us in the region, we're seeing a lot of multifamily development coming out of the recession, which is understandable. That's a nationwide trend, but it's one that certainly we've collectively as a region set ourselves up well for here. So if we look at the number of units we've had since the post-recession, that's 3,300 units that have been, and so 70% have been multifamily. If we look at all the units since 2000, we've got 45% of our entire housing stock has been multifamily.
So 45% is looking at your entire city, 70% is
what's been new. Since 2010, 70%. So at post-recession. So we think it's kind of interesting to look at that post-recession period, and then we're sort of looking back a little bit at 2000.
45% overall?
From 2000, and we're actually more like 50-50 in our entire housing stock, actually.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, no, we're right at 50-50 in the city, similar to Beaverton, similar to other large suburban communities that have, you know, followed the policies of the region. So we have, since 2010, we've got 25% are single family, and obviously I think we've all talked and seen in our region that single family has lagged behind multifamily, and so we are seeing, and I'll be talking a little bit about that more, but while it's been 25% of post-recession, so since 2010, for Hillsborough it's 40% of all of our dwelling units since 2000. And whoops, hopefully I didn't flip ahead. Now 5%, this is an interesting figure here. This is a 5% of our housing stock that's attached. And I would just put in a plug here to, as I'm having the opportunity to speak to regional policymakers and decision makers, is that we need to do more probably as a region and as a state to enhance the opportunities for ownership in attached products, condominiums, co-ops, those types of things, because it creates a ladder of success for people. And so I know that we don't see a lot of that. I certainly talk to the development community, and we're seeing some nascent new projects coming out as condominiums, but I just think that that's an important section. It's a different kind of middle, if you will, of housing where people can find affordability and ownership product. Obviously, affordability is a huge issue in general. So focused growth. I think we've all been working on that. Hillsborough has certainly been working on that for a number of years, and everybody will recognize the following map. This, of course, is a blow-up of the metropolitan or the metro 2040 growth concept on the western end of the region in our area. And so, of course, planning for housing is intended to be in station areas, communities, corridors, centers, and we've been doing that. In our case, in Hillsborough, we've been seeing really large numbers in the Willow Creek station area, in the Orenco station, as well as the Katama station, and now in our downtown. And we are working, and in fact, this evening, I'm not with my planning commission where I normally am, and they are actually having what we believe will be the final hearing on our new comprehensive plan, which I'll talk about a little bit more as the evening goes on. Now, I'm going to give you a little animation. So this is less words, sorry, Tom, more fun in the sense of animations. And so this is where you can see in Hillsborough where the new dwelling units are happening since 2000, and there is a pattern there that you see is really reflective of the centers and station areas along the way. So I think that just illustrates the growth. It's also interesting on the southern part of this animation, sort of on the bottom end of it, that's a Witch Hazel, and Witch Hazel was an urban growth boundary area that came in with an 1,100 unit projection, and we've built 1,074 of those units, and we'll see a photograph of that in a little bit. So it just helps do that. Now, of course, you know, to further emphasize where those dwelling units were happening and where they were being built, 24% of the 3,200 units in were built within 1/4 mile of a light rail station, and 44% of the new units have been built within, and that's 5,900 units within 1/2 mile of light rail. Fully 60% of our new units have been built within 1/4 mile of some type of transit, and fully 89% have been built within 1/2 mile of transit. That sounds really good, but I'm going to make a point here and take the opportunity to say, and I'm going to quote Mr. McFarland, and that may not be the best, you know, may not be that great, but he did say it in a public room in front of a large audience, which is that TriMet service on the west end of Washington County is skeletal at best. That's his quote. And we ask for more support because we're doing our part. We're trying to put housing in the right place next to transit, but candidly, we don't have as much transit. And I know probably everybody would say that, but I will say that for Hillsborough. We have a great light rail line. We have a great, you know, line on TV Highway, but outside of that, we have very low service. We'd like to have more. With regard to, doesn't everybody want more, right? So here's some more breakdown in numbers with regard. We've just finished, as I mentioned, the comprehensive plan at the city, and as part of that, we did a housing needs analysis. And so some of these numbers come here, and we can see that we have more households than we have units in the range that would be in the norm for high income. And obviously, like the rest of the region, we have significantly more households than units available for the low end. So that's our issue. We have in the 20-year supply, we don't meet our demand. So our capacity doesn't meet our ultimate demand as we see it in the mix of housing. And so that's where we're at. And here, to answer your question, Councillor Harrington demonstrates that difference between the multifamily and the single family there on that bar graph on the right. So that shows that. I will note that on the single family or a one bedroom apartment in Hillsborough, I think we're second to Portland, where our average rent for a single bedroom apartment is now $1,300 in Hillsborough. So it's pretty high in, you know, my view. And I think like the rest of the region, we're seeing, you know, people who are building new multifamily building for the upper income part of the market. And so, we're just seeing these huge pricing challenges for our community. So this is just a quick slide of, our goals in this new comprehensive plan, and really wanted to emphasize that while we've always found a way to get it done, our new comprehensive plan and the policies that are being recommended to the mayor and the city council in the next month will include lots of innovative efforts to really emphasize, you know, co-op housing, small houses, cluster housing, cottage housing, all of the types of things that everybody in the region is looking in the housing toolbox to achieve to make sure that we create what in Hillsborough we call balanced housing, so that we're creating a spectrum of choice for people across the entire width of our community. And so that's very important. We're also really, so it's really a lot about design moving forward and innovation, looking at all those opportunities. The City Council has decision makers across the region, leaders, have recognized the challenge of affordable housing, and so we have a special task force in the housing affordability team, and so we're working that as a priority, and the City Council has had several work sessions looking at many of the tools that you already discussed with Tom this evening,
And so I won't go back through those, and we're looking at ways to be effective in our area, which are probably a little different than in, you know, maybe the central city, but we think that we're going to be very successful in helping diversify the amount of affordable housing available. So I'm going to continue here with some hopefully fun stuff. So we'll start with infill development. We don't have a huge amount of secondary dwelling units, but we encourage them. We're going to continue to encourage them. This is a quick look at going into the Orenco Village area and station area, and where, you know, you have SDUs that are created on the backside of an alley-loaded lot, so it's really seamless. It's very beautiful, but we are seeing an increasing number of them. Affordable housing, again, tonight at our Planning Commission, where I'm not at, but I am enjoying being here. We are working with our partners at the Washington County Housing Authority to bring this particular development to the Willow Creek Station. And this is a development that is in a prime location to serve many people. This is a 121-unit multifamily six-story development that is proposed right at the light rail station, right on several high-capacity bus lines, and right next to PCC, so in close proximity to services and jobs. So we're very excited about partnering with the Washington County Housing Authority. And this just demonstrates, you know, yet another example of our city's commitment to affordable housing. We have, I believe, Metro's 2015 Regional Inventory of Regulated Affordable Housing noted that Hillsborough has the highest share of regulated affordable housing units of any suburban community. And of our affordable units, 17% are located in concentrated poverty areas, which I believe may be the highest in the region. So we, and then we have a significant inventory of, you know, non-regulated affordable housing. And, you know, there was the discussion, I think, by Commissioner Scott, is that correct, about preservation. And, you know, that is another tool that our council is looking at, certainly, is the preservation of affordable units. So redevelopment's another big part of providing housing opportunities, and that commitment to ensure housing is included in the downtown purchase by our council in December of 2016 of a former grocery site. This is an aerial view of what was called the Hanks Block. We now call it Block 67. It's a grocery store that closed down. It's adjacent directly to what we call the Health and Education District, the Tualatin and Pacific University combined campus in our downtown, in very close proximity to our historic Main Street. And here it is now. The old grocery store has been taken off. The city, again, owns this land but is not going to be the developer. We currently have a RFQ out now to, and not a P, but a request for qualifications, and we have a number of development teams that are looking at providing market rate and affordable housing mixed use. This is just one example of the possibility of opportunities, and as I noted, that's a 400 by 400 block, so that's double the size of Portland, so we're looking at all sorts of maybe alleys and nice ways to break up this block to make it a very walkable place, and we're very excited about its opportunity in our downtown. So we're expecting a significant, you know, as many as 300 or 400 additional units here at that location. In neighborhood redevelopment, and it's really exciting for me to report this out, because I know people like Councillor Harrington and Councillor Collette were around back when the city of Hillsborough came to the Metro Council, and we requested that the council consider redesignating the Amberglen Business Park into a regional center, and to redevelop what was essentially a now somewhat obsolete business park. And what you see in front of you is what is actually happening on the ground, and we're really pleased to be able to describe to you how we're regridding this area of former super blocks to do exactly what we promised, which was to improve walkability, bikeability, and then bring multifamily close proximity to jobs, services. And so these are just a couple of the examples that are happening out there, and they are truly happening. So there's rendering to reality. And so it's very exciting. The green space you see before you was previously in private ownership, and our city council has stepped up and taken ownership of that land. So that will be a central park, which was, as one of our planning commissioners described many years ago, the soul of the Amberglen plan, and it really creates the green central space. It's an 11-acre park that's pretty beautiful, and our Parks Department will be doing a lot of wonderful things. But meanwhile, on the housing side, we've already got 1,500 new units in what I consider tier one or pioneering development, and we will undoubtedly see property values rise, so that you see in the background some of the single-story tilt-up concrete flex office spaces. We expect those to redevelop. For those of you who aren't around during those discussions, we expect property values to increase. Councillor Harrington.
One of the renderings in your prior slide, one rendering was a four-story and the other rendering looked like more of a five or six-story.
So this four-story that's going in here, call that a low rise or a mid rise?
You know, it's low mid. You know, it is not as high as I would. You know, I'd like it to be bigger, of course. I'd like it to be like some of our products that we've seen at the Urenco station, but, you know, this is sort of that pioneer effort. And so, yeah, I'd call this sort of low.
When we did make the move, and made this a regional center, many of the renderings were at least six. And I'm wondering if you still see capacity. You mentioned redeveloping those current employment buildings. Do you still see an opportunity to end up with buildings that are six stories or so in the remaining area?
Oh, without question, Councillor Harrington. And so to be in truth in advertising, I mean, I recall very much routinely saying that our first pioneering generation of development would be four to six. So we always said four because we knew that was immediately achievable. Six was a little bit aspirational even on the pioneer development. And so you see in those renderings, there are ones coming in at six.
Coming in at the target.
Yeah.
And that's important for us on the council to learn as we go through this urban growth management cycle.
Well, without question, I mean, our minimum density was 43 dwelling units an acre, and of course everybody thinks, wow, that's not very much, but, you know, I have to remind everybody it wasn't too long ago that everybody got pretty excited when you had 20 dwelling units an acre in suburbia. And so now we're at minimum at 43 and way up, and so we're very excited about it. So then new development, and in this case we'll talk a little bit about South Hillsborough, and of course this area has also subject to urban growth boundary decisions by the Metro Council in 2010, and then the further ratification by the state legislature through House Bill 4078. And since this has taken a long time to bring in, and people will recognize the polygon there, and this is about 1,400 acres, and this area is now well into development. And in fact, since the fall, we've entitled 2,000 units, and the units that you see in these PUDs include attached single-family small lot, and what we now call large lot, which is 7,000 and 8,000 square foot lots, which is large lot. This area includes a significant number of community parks as well. A large community park. The city has already purchased 60 acres of land in advance of development to ensure that the community park occurs. Neighborhood parks are being developed as we speak. And we are very excited about the development that's occurring. It's taken a long time. I think I made a presentation to MPAC a little over a year ago about the challenges of financing South Hillsborough, which were great. The city, through partnerships with Washington County, as well as our private sector partners,
have basically ensured that we can finance $430 million worth of infrastructure over the 20 years of the planning horizon of South Hillsborough. I personally think that it's going to develop very rapidly, maybe with some exceptions of small partialized areas, but otherwise we think there is a significant latent demand for single-family housing. And as you may recall at the beginning of my presentation, I said only, you know, what we had, is it 15-20%, you know, of our existing housing stock since the Great Recession has been in single-family detached. And I think there's a lot of evidence out there and data that demonstrates that the millennials are finally pairing up and they are going to start doing what people may do, which is seeking out a single family home, even if it's on a very small lot. I will also now ask you to buckle your seatbelts. We're going to go for a flight. So you're going to see, I hope. I'm looking at the technical people. Do I need to push this again or wait? Just wait, I'm told. So what I'm excited to show you is you're going to see the beginning of a significant amount of infrastructure. It equals about $30 million money spent. And every one of the roads that you see, not those particular roads, sorry, but most of the roads you see will include cycle tracks, which will include, there you go. So this is Century Boulevard going down into the Rosedale PUD, which will be the home of the Street of Dreams next year. This is Butternut Creek, south of Butternut Creek to the left, protecting all those corridors, of course. The tagline for South Hillsborough has always been complete, connected, and green. Complete in that it offers all the different housing product types as well as opportunities for retail services, commercial services, and jobs. And most of these areas were large farm areas. This is the old Ladd and Reed farm, which is, you know, some of you might know if you've been around for a while, the St. Mary's property. And again, includes a significant amount of off-street walking paths and bike trails. And again, every one of those arterials you see here in these drone flights are going to have cycle tracks. So we are really working very hard at creating a place that, you know, if you choose to use an automobile, you know, it'll be hopefully rarely, and you'll be able to be just as comfortable walking and cycling to and from your community and throughout your community. So we're very excited. But this is, it's a lot of earth moving. It's a lot of construction, a lot of effort on behalf of many people. This is Tualatin Valley Highway and the Corn Pass intersection. This is, I'm told by ODOT, the largest at-grade rail crossing in the state of Oregon, and is a significant achievement to occur and to really was the gateway to begin this whole thing. So that is South Hillsborough. Here's just a few quick snapshots of some of the housing product. Nothing too exciting. I apologize to the polish that I'm saying that, but not exciting. This is just attached product that we would expect to see and that we've already approved designs for people to be able to live in. Single, small lot, detached homes with varying styles of architecture. We've worked very hard to make sure that we have significant design standards for glazing, reduced, you know, garage faces, and lots of off-street pathways like this one that you see. So we're so future development, I wanted to just say that we will be, as a city, applying that little boot-shaped polygon in this is what we call Witch Hazel South. And I mentioned Witch Hazel earlier this evening, which was a urban growth boundary expansion, I believe in part of it in 02 and maybe part of it 05, that we're virtually built out on. And now we will, in the 2018 cycle as a city, be asking for a urban growth boundary expansion to this location, just because as we've identified in a previous report to the Metro Council, it takes a long time to go from urban growth boundary to turning dirt. So we noted throughout the region it was a six-year average. And so in that sense, we're asking for this change. And here's an aerial of the existing Witch Hazel. And as you can see, it's developed at a high density. We have attached product here. We have detached product here. We have a very nice, that diagonal is an allee. that is going through there, not an alley, but an alley, and a nice place for you to stroll to what will be a future commercial node. And we have two schools, a middle school and an elementary school here, so really a complete community. And then the area that I was just describing is to the south of the schools, and it's a modest increase, and we're doing concept planning now for that area, and again would be a mixture of housing types. And so I will close with this picture, which I'm always very excited to share with people. This is a picture that basically looks at the Orenco Station area, which is at the Hub 9, which is the building that sort of has the clock tower. It's sort of just off center. That's a 100 dwelling units an acre type of building, and so the entire thing is averages at about 80, which we're really proud about. And then as you move north in this picture, you're looking at the original Orenco Station, which has a whole complement of single-family detached triplexes that look like single homes, so it's that middle housing that we're all seeking. So we have also in the Orenco Station 200 units of affordable housing, and they're all in close proximity to that small development in the back there, which is the Intel Rondler Acres campus. It's a small $40 billion investment that Intel has made in our region. And what really excites me about this picture, and I think hopefully some of you already recognized it, which is not the $40 billion that I'm now saying a second time, but it's really the transect. This is a transect of what makes this region great. This is a transect because as you continue to move north above Intel, we're now passing the urban growth boundary, and we're looking at the other foundation of the state land use system, which is the protection of resource land. So that's what this represents to me, is that whole continuum, a transect from station area community, mixed use, livability, in close proximity to jobs, all the way out to single family, traditional and jobs, and then ultimately the protection of resources that we all value so much in the state of Oregon. Thanks. Any questions?
Yeah, could you go back to the one that had the elementary schools? I just want to know if you have an approximate figure, how many students would be going to Callaway Elementary?
I already have
you. No, I'm sure the mayor may be able to tell us that, you know, wonderful ratio of teachers to students and, you know, 20 kids to every classroom.
I wasn't looking for an answer. I was just being a smart ass.
I remember when the first buildings went in at Orenco, this development, this growth is just amazing.
Yes.
It was just the stuff on the main street and nothing else. Yeah.
I just want to thank both of our presenters. I learned a lot. A lot of hard work's gone into the results and of each of your cities, so thank you for sharing it with us.
Yes.
All right, and I think with that we are adjourned.
And how fun to be able to put in that infrastructure.